Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the House Interim Committee on Human Services. Welcome everybody that's here and those who may be listening or watching elsewhere. My co-chair, Carolyn Tomei, and I will be sharing the gavel as usual. Not as usual, but we will be sharing it today. Usually it's every other day. So we're combining our duties today, and my job is to get us started. And our first order of business is interim committee rules. And the rules have changed slightly, and before I ask her to do it, I want to make sure everybody knows who Cheyenne Ross is, a veteran of our building, and we're very happy that she's joining us as our administrator, as well as Christy Houck, who's handling our assistant duties, just right down the dais right there. So we're glad you're here. We're glad that Representative Harker's here. And if you would, Cheyenne, just say a word about the changes before we move to adopt the rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the differences between the regular session rules and the interim rules generally reflect a reduction that's appropriate to the function of the committee during the interim. All the stuff about carrying over bills, minority reports, things that have to do with the processing of the bills is removed, and what you have is specific to interim functions. They are otherwise substantially the same as other interims. And a couple of new rules, rule number 7 and rule number 13, they're new in language, but they're part of the usual practice.
Good. Are there any questions or comments on? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion, Madam Chair.
Chair Gilliam, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 23rd, 2011.
Chair Tomei moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 23rd, 2001. Any discussion?
One.
That is what he said.
Excuse me, just a minute.
We have gone right back in time.
I meant to say 2011. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative
Bailey. Excused.
Representative Harper.
Aye.
Representative
Parrish. I'm not sure what we're voting on.
Do we approve the rules?
Oh, fine. Like yes, them. Aye. That's fine. They're fine.
Representative Widener.
Well, I'm not sure if I want to now, but I suppose I'll vote aye.
Screw that up for you. Co-Vice Chair
Frederick.
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
The rules are adopted. Representative Widener?
Well, I was going to say, could we let Representative Greenlick vote? But you went faster than...
No, we could have done it before suspending the rules.
All right.
You're assigned to sit here.
I think it's the other way around.
Quite a foul. I think Julie should have watched both of us.
Representative Greenlick, do you care to vote on the rules?
I would be delighted to.
Then I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules.
Mr.
So
Chair?
Yep, Mr. Representative Widener.
I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Greenlick to vote, and we wouldn't have had to go through this motion if the chair would have listened to his pupils at the dais. Thank you.
There is a motion in there someplace, and do I need to ask for those that are in favor of suspending the rules? Any discussion on this motion?
Probably should discuss it.
You want that disruptive influence?
Seeing none, the rules are suspended, and I'm going to ask the clerk to ask Representative Greenlick for his vote on the rules.
Representative Greenlick.
Aye.
The motion carries now unanimously, and I'm going to close the organizational part of our meeting with the rules adopted. I'm going to open an informational meeting for the interim committee, and what we'll do is we will move through this agenda probably as you all have already received it, and for the first subject of problem gambling, I'm going to turn the gavel gladly over to my co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Kenmer, I believe you want to speak on this bill, and then we'll bring up some of the other advocates on this issue. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, currently representing Oregon City Canby areas. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about problem gambling. A little ringing here. This has been a topic of considerable interest. Starting back when I returned to the legislature in 2009, a number of us have introduced bills on this topic and have particular concern about gambling addiction and treatment and making sure that monies go to treatment. Thus far, those bills have not been very successful. So I'm hoping that maybe the committee would consider introducing this as a committee bill. I think we need to have a good discussion about the lottery and about what we're doing and what our goals are and its impact on our citizens. And let me just, I'm going to take a few moments and highlight some points, and then there are some experts and others involved who will come and follow with more details. And I want to thank many of them for working with me and helping me with information and statistics. But I'd like to set the stage just a bit. I don't know if you're aware, but Oregon is either the highest or one of the highest states with regards to gambling addicts per capita in the United States. I think that ought to be a concern, and it ought to be a concern when approximately 77,000 Oregonians are addicted to gambling in Oregon. And I would note that this is also a growth industry in the recession. Just 3 years ago, the estimate was 70,000. So that's a 10% increase in those 3 years or less. And with that, incidentally, and I forgot to do the math on this, the average addict, and there are 77,000 of them, also has $30,000 in debt. I just pause for a moment because I remember when I first read that, it took a moment to sink in. $30,000 in debt. The impact upon them and their families is substantial. And of course, the range is from zero to, well, I guess one was over $1 million. But it's an enormous amount of debt that people are carrying as a result of this addiction. But perhaps the part that I think as legislators we need to even be more concerned about is the reality that approximately 65,000 of those 77,000 addicted Oregonians are addicted to Oregon's video poker. Oregon's video poker. Our game. Because the issue is that video addictions are related to access. And video poker, Oregon's video poker, is available in nearly every neighborhood bar and tavern and other facilities right next to us. And it's not only readily available, but we also know that some 80 to 90% of addictions are around video poker because it's the most addictive of the gambling addictions. It sounded like a Gilliam statement. I apologize. I think another point about this is we have about 1,700 Oregonians in treatment. Well, that's around 2%. And we have a requirement that 1% of lottery proceeds be spent on treatment, and to Ways and Means credit, they've been working towards that. But across the years, this has been shorted periodically. I think also of concern to me is something that happened back in 2008 at the beginning, towards the beginning of our current recession. Historically there's an interesting history. Back when video poker was introduced, I was in the Senate in those days. I voted against that expansion because of its addictive nature. But one of the informal rules that the Lottery Commission had was that they would not do TV advertising of video poker. They did do some of that in 2008 in the height of the recession. And I think one of the things we want to be careful about is advertising the most addictive form of gambling addiction there is possible. And I think it merits some some responsibility on the part of the legislature. To their credit, they stopped those and to my knowledge have not done them since. But I do have some concerns about that. And I think, let me highlight just a couple of examples of the ways that this impacts Oregon citizens. I saw this in my own family when one of our family members lost his job back in 2008. He did something that a lot of people do. He spent the next 2 months of his unemployment checks gambling. Now, later on, we had a conversation, and he had said, you know, it was one of the dumbest things he'd ever done. But he also said, you know, I just was faced with the fact I didn't have enough money. And we've all been in those hearings where we've heard people doing that with their public assistance money and other things. That ready access is a big problem. Fortunately, in his case, he got his act together. The other piece of this, too, is that we talk about the expense. Well, and it's hard to itemize that expense for those who actually get addicted, but there are other ways. For example, just in my county, there have been two major embezzlements that have made the press in the last several years. In West Lynn, there was an administrator. $1.4 million she embezzled from the city. That's tax money. That's public money that was taken. I suspect in good faith, in hopes she always thought she probably would pay it back, but that's just the way gambling addicts think, and the video poker machine takes away more than it gives back, so that's the way it works. Or let's go out to Estacada. Here in a small rural fire department, over a 10-year period, $2 million was embezzled. It was interesting. I had hoped to bring some business people here to testify about this too, because it is a big problem among some of our businesses, because if they're not careful, they find that some of their employees are embezzling money. But most all of them are not willing to talk about it publicly for fear of being accused of slander, and also because they want to safeguard their public reputation. But substantial amounts of money, and I don't know how in the world we ever quantify what that might be, because most of these matters are settled with firings and settlement agreements. But substantial amounts of money are being lost. So I hope that the committee will consider putting together legislation, and I guess I would suggest there are five things that I'd like you to, at least from my perspective and others that you might want to talk about. I think one, that the legislature needs to deal with its addiction. We're addicted to this money. And I think we bear some responsibility for the social outcomes that addiction is bringing upon 77,000 Oregonians, or particularly the 65,000 that are addicted to Oregon Video Lottery. I think we ought to think about setting some goals for how much money is enough, because you know, you are getting to a point where the cost is more than the benefit. I think there are probably some lessons from Prohibition and other things. We're not going to get rid of gambling in Oregon, but maybe we need to make it less available, and maybe we need to also augment treatment, because obviously not enough people are getting treatment, and the impacts of $30,000 per addict in Oregon, that's got to be a big drain on people, particularly in a recession time. Thirdly, I think that we maybe want to create some other rules around this. Maybe we want to say that advertising a video poker sentence is so highly addictive is just not legal, or some other way to rein this in. Because I think that's the game. That's the game that's getting most of our Oregonians in trouble. Oregon video poker. And then finally, I think it's interesting that the lottery has the challenge of providing the ads that call for people to get treatment. Yes, thank you for the smile. I appreciate you listening. And I just think, while I don't mean to impugn anyone's motives or intentions, And I think in certain ways it's appropriate that they do that. But I do think, you know, asking Budweiser to run commercials about why people should not drink beer excessively probably is not the right direction to go. And I think that's a good example of what we maybe need to think about with video poker and Oregon Lottery. So maybe we need to think about who does the advertising and what it is, and particularly those who are advocating for treatment, maybe we need to approach that from a little different philosophical angle. And so those would be my five recommendations to the committee. And at this point, maybe you have comments or questions. I'd love to take them. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Kenemer? Representative Greenlich.
Thank you. Representative Kenemer knows I share his concern, and I share our concern about our addiction as a state to the lottery money. And I think there are ways, I believe, to get rid of it, and we ought to be thinking about those seriously. But I would say saying that the lottery shouldn't be involved in advertising for gambling addiction is probably not what we want. We probably want them to do it. But we want other channels for that as well, because we need more channels. But the major problem, and the lottery will say to us, well, our instructions from you, the legislature, are maximize gambling
yes.
revenue. And as long as that's the instruction, then they are legitimized to do whatever they need to do to maximize gambling revenue. And,
yeah.
and I mean, I think we know who the enemy is here. The enemy is us. It's something we need to really pay attention to. So I really commend you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and Representative Greenlech, thank you. And yes, I did overstate that. I think we're going to have to add advertising. Advertising is how you make things work. On the other hand, you know, I'm one of those who plays megabucks whenever it gets over 50 million. I kind of have this arbitrary deal. You know, if it's less than 50 million, who cares? And if I'm going to win, I want to win big. And the other side of that, though, is I usually spend a dollar or two at the most, because, but, you know, and we're not going to stop gambling, and it's fun. And frankly, also, it's kind of an interesting thing. You might want to think about winning $100 million and think about what you would do with it. It's kind of an interesting investigation of what your own personal ethics and values are. So
keep farming till it runs out.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So this summer I had the opportunity to go and spend some time down in Multnomah County at the drug court, and spent some time with one of the judges down there. A couple things that I thought were interesting is, you know, just how much the problem gambling is also tied to, you know, the drug piece, and those things go hand in hand for a lot of addicts. Same type of addictive behavior, and personally saw that happen with, you know, my sister who just passed this summer. So, and so there's the additional cost of the criminal piece that goes with the problem gambling and the drugs, and those, again, those things kind of go together. I asked this judge, I said, how much money with all of the criminal piece that you're sitting down here with Multnomah County, and a lot of this is tied to these types of activity, how much money are you sitting on in unpaid restitution? And the answer was $100 million that they just feel like they're not going to collect. $100 million in assorted fines for, you know, not all related to gambling, but certainly a lot of those problems that are linked. I can't, and I'm going to gamble, so I'm going to steal from somebody, I'm going to take their credit card or whatever, and, you know, we get picked up on an ID charge theft, you know, and then that come to find out that person has a problem gambling, but they're out, you know, now saying that they're Bill Kenemer, and they steal his wallet and his driver's license and all the other, you know, criminality that goes with this for some of these folks.
Yeah.
$100 million. That is a ton of money that we're not going to collect, and we spend a lot of money, time, and effort trying to collect those dollars. When you think about, you know, just how that structure works, and if we put even a fraction of that into prevention, you know, I just appreciate you bringing it forward, because that's just one county. So Washington County's got the same problem. Clackamas, all the way through the state, is the other cost that goes with this, is the criminal piece and the recidivism tied to the addiction. So,
thank you, Representative. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kinnemer, remember this last time coming through, and I mean, the examples that you talk about are examples that happened in my county as well, in the small town. I mean, we had somebody with one of our cities that was embezzling money, using it to go play video poker. But I'm just, you've been involved with this pretty heavy. A lot of the casinos and stuff, they'll have players' cards. And I'm wondering if there's a way we can monitor it with individuals, possibly with a player's card or something like that, because I also know of people that had shaky relationships and the husband went out and mortgaged against the house and everything else and took a house that was basically paid off and borrowed $100,000 against it and had lost all of that in gambling. And it was all video poker as well, in one of the local bars. So, and was always talking about how much he won because he never counted what he put in. So, wondering if we could come up with a way where there's a shutoff where a person has a limit, $20, $50, whatever it might be for that machine. Because we're going into a sticky area, because once you get into the bars and restaurants that have these machines, some of them, that's the only way they're open. I know small communities, they rely on those machines to stay afloat now, because we've created the addiction for them as well by doing it. And the only way I see around it is when you get into a table or a regular poker table where a guy buys in for $50, you're there for 3 hours and you don't get to play anymore. You're in for that amount and you're kind of capped, where a machine just keeps sucking it and sucking it. So I'm wondering, have you looked into anything like the player's card or any way that we can control it that way?
Chair Tomei and Representative Widener, I have not. You know, I'm intrigued with some of the statistics about this. For example, poker, while it's a favorite game of a lot of people, it's not very addictive in terms of the addiction, because it's something that you typically, well, some people, I guess there are always exceptions, but generally you're going to go someplace and do it less. It's kind of like the data on the Indian casinos. They're not a big piece of the addiction problem, because people, except for maybe the few people who live close by, because you go to them. You know, my neighbors are wonderful examples. They love going about 3 or 4 times a year, and they have a big wing-ding there, and but they're a long ways from addicts, because they have a set amount, and they have a ball, and it's over with. I think when you get down to monitoring people, that's going to be a pretty sticky wicket. I'm not sure I'm ready for I'm not ready for that, but...
I may follow up.
But I don't know. Yeah.
And then we need to move on.
Yeah, because I think with the addiction is what's going on, it's not about the money, it's about winning.
Yeah.
It's just like the guys who play Texas Hold'em, everything else. Most of the guys that are there aren't playing for the money. They want to win the tournament. So if they buy in for $10 or whatever, they just are there to win. I mean, it's the competitive nature of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens with the machines, is they're just wanting to win, and every time they hit that, for whether it's $10 or $600, they're just counting the wins and not the losses that are going in. And that's where I see the issue being. It's as we get older and more out of shape, and we take our competitive natures to other spots, I think is what happens.
Yeah.
With some of these people.
We have some folks here, I think, will be able to maybe answer some of our questions.
Madam Chair, if I could add just one last thing. Thank you. The other thing is, if you haven't visited a video poker place, I would encourage you to go there. Go and sit in the back and gently watch. Try not to make these people uncomfortable, but I think you'll be astounded at how rapidly many of these people play this. I do not believe that they really are able to keep track of the score or how it's going. and you can see the mesmerizing and the addiction in action. And it's really quite a frightening experience, and it's part of what has caused me to realize how very dangerous this is. I thank you all for your time and your graciousness.
Thank you. I look forward to working with you on this issue. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Nell.
And we have Jeff Murata. Am I pronouncing that, Jeff?
Yes.
Carol Hardy and Karen Wheeler. And there's another gentleman whom I don't recognize. Are you here to testify, sir, on this issue?
No.
Oh, okay. Thank you all for coming. So start wherever you want.
I'm going to defer to you.
Okay. Thank you for inviting us here. We appreciate it, Chair Tomei. I'm Carol Hardy. I am the Assistant Director for Marketing for the Oregon Lottery. I have worked for them for 24 years. And as Representative Greenlicht did allude to, my first obligation is to say our mission assigned to us through the Constitution is to maximize revenue for the state of Oregon for good causes. The other part of that mission is commensurate with the public good. And every director and commission that I have worked through has taken that commitment of balance very seriously, as I do personally. I just want to give you a little bit of background on what our responsible gambling program is and what commensurate to the public good means to the people who manage the Oregon Lottery. So this was mentioned earlier, problem gambling treatment funding. 1% of Oregon Lottery profits are statutorily dedicated to fund problem gambling treatment. This money is managed by the Oregon Health Authority, and the Oregon Lottery Commission is behind the full support of this funding, and we have made that known through our communication to the legislature. It was also mentioned that the Oregon Lottery dedicates a portion of its administrative budget to fund problem gambling outreach programs. The lottery consults with members of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. Dr. Jeff Murata is one of those members. Dr. Tom Moore, other folks in the room are part of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. And we also work with members from the treatment and prevention community to identify at-risk groups and to develop messaging and programs to bring in for more information to those at risk. So we do consult with experts to say how should these messages be crafted. The Oregon Lottery's ongoing program has four distinct goals: to increase the number of people in need seeking treatment through promoting the 1-877 My Limit hotline and website. This helpline service is funded by part of the 1% of lottery profits, and it's managed through a third-party contract by the Oregon Health Authority. This number is posted on every video lottery terminal. I would point out that is the number one source cited where people get the information. So people are in those environments. That's where they see the helpline number. That may be why more of the people who come into treatment actually cite video lottery as a game of choice. And it is also included on the lottery's website. It's on posters and brochures provided to every retailer. It's on television ads, radio ads, outdoor and interactive advertisements. We also educate Oregonians to set a time limit and budget limits when they play. This is a best practice, one of the few that's come out of the industry to say this is a way of getting people to avoid getting into a problem. We have consulted with Dr. Murata over the years. He is one who has brought this to our attention as a sound practice to educate our players. These messages are also included in various TV, print, interactive, and other advertisements. Our third obligation is to educate our Oregon Lottery retailers on their staff on how to manage responsible gambling within their establishments. It is required that 100% of Oregon Lottery retailers are trained on this issue of problem gambling. And contractually, our retailers are required to post problem gambling information, are required to cut people off from playing lottery games if they're visibly intoxicated. They will lose their contract with us if they violate those requirements. Fourthly, very importantly, we continue to try to understand what type of messages are effective in reaching potential problem gamblers and their families through conducting various types of research, both formal and informal. We track the number of calls to helpline and hits to the website to judge the effectiveness of our outreach efforts and change them accordingly. The Oregon Lottery spends approximately $1.5 million annually on these programs. That's only reflective of the money we spend. Most TV and radio stations who run our ads match those spots purchased at no charge, doubling our exposure since the ads are perceived as a public service announcement. I also already mentioned this earlier. The Oregon Council on Problem Gambling is a group the Oregon Lottery has been involved with. It's taken different forms over the years, but since the early 1990s, we have been involved with the various prevention and outreach groups. For the past 4 years, I've served as president of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. It's a private nonprofit organization affiliated with the National Council on Problem Gambling. The council's mission is to support effective, efficient, and sustainable treatment and prevention of problem gambling in Oregon. The board of the council has diverse membership representing different interests in the state, including prevention, treatment, the tribes, Oregon Restaurant Association. More information about the council can be found at our website. So that was the information I had to share. I'd be happy to ask questions or pass it to my colleagues.
Thank you. I think I'm going to hold questions until everyone has testified here. Thank you so much for coming.
Welcome.
Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I am Jeff Parada. I run a consulting business that focuses solely on problem gambling. I work with many different jurisdictions, federal governments, and state agencies to help them develop programs and policies to mitigate gambling-related harm. I also had the privilege to serve as the Problem Gambling Services Manager here in Oregon for 7 years between 2000 and 2007. One of the projects that I'm currently involved in, one that is near and dear to my heart, is Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery is an organization that provides a voice for those affected by problem gambling. They're individuals who provide firsthand witness to the impacts of problem gambling. I'm so pleased to be part of this group because I am a member of it as well. My father was a problem gambler, so I firsthand have experienced what it's like to go through the thralls and of living in a household of problem gambling and recognize firsthand the kind of devastation that could cause. Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery is made up, as I said, of people in recovery from gambling problems, also family members, friends. There's some therapists there as well that are invested in this project. We go around and we try to educate others of the issues. We work with policymakers to help craft or identify potential holes in policy and ways to address the issues that problem gambling creates for the citizens of Oregon. We also go out and through our members demonstrate that treatment works. We have this organization is not anonymous. Individuals can choose to remain so. However, many go and directly speak to the impacts of problem gambling from their experience. We have a couple members, Rita and Nate, who in their midlife developed a very serious gambling problem. It's really created significant issues with their family, damaging relationships with their children, with their spouse. They both ended up without a job. They both ended up in dire straits, one very close to losing her life due to this condition. They turned to the Oregon treatment system. They received help. One of them received help both as an outpatient and as a residential client. And now I can tell you through working with them as members of Voices that they are now productive members of society. They are giving back. They are contributing. They have turned their life around. And they couldn't have done this without the treatment that is available here in Oregon. Both of them are back in going to school, and they're now in their mid-40s, one getting a degree in business, and the other one wants to become a counselor. These are just two examples of the really many that are out there of the types of harm that gambling causes, and also the hope that it's available for individuals who have fallen into the despairs of problem gambling. We also have family members that participating and can likewise tell stories of the impacts that problem gambling has on them and ways that treatment has helped them as well. The one of the things that I feel privileged about is speaking to you all today. We are talking today about something that is often considered a hidden addiction, something that doesn't get talked about. It is really an honor to be here and to have all of you engaging in this conversation, a discussion that does not take place as nearly as often as I think it should in order to do the citizens of Oregon due justice. This is a significant problem. You've heard about from Representative Kennemer about the scope of this problem, and I think he's just kind of touched on the tip of the iceberg there. You heard about some things that are being done to address this problem, and I think we need to be proud here in Oregon about some of the accomplishments that we have made in addressing problem gambling, both by promoting responsible gambling and through our treatment and prevention efforts. However, there is more work to be done, and I'm so glad that you're taking up this cause and ready to go and approach this issue to find ways to improve services for Oregonians and harm mitigation and to improve the health of Oregonians by addressing problem gambling. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I would just echo what Jeff just said about being honored to be here and talk with this committee about this subject again, and the energy and effort that you all have put into educating yourselves about this problem, as well as the successful and evidence-based strategies, actually, that can help resolve this problem in the state of Oregon. The only thing that I would add is to talk a little bit about some of the service improvements and innovations that we've been able to implement because of the funding that we do receive from the 1% lottery revenues. We recently revised our rules for all addictions and mental health programs so that they screen clients for problem gambling. This didn't used to be a requirement. Now it is. So the providers, in an effort to reach more people and have more case identification with people that have a co-occurring issue of gambling, that's an effort to do that. We've also added a code and an ability to fund outreach activities. So for people that deliver these services, and I would also add that these services are provided by nonprofit, by and large, nonprofit organizations locally. So everything is done at the local level. So they're able to bill for things like outreach activities to try to reach more people with a message about getting into treatment or getting help and that it's free and confidential. We've also implemented some, I would call, pretty innovative efforts in a pilot to do counseling over the web. So for people that may not want to come into a clinical setting or they live in a remote area of the state of Oregon, we've been doing this with a dedicated Skype line. So, and then there's also some telephone counseling and web chat counseling that's done through the 24-hour helpline. So those are just some of the things that I would add. In addition to that, the funding has gone up and down, sort of waxed and waned over the years. If we had more resources, we could really, I believe, keep people, not in treatment, but really extend the continuum of services for some people who need recovery support services. Things like peer-to-peer mentoring, coaching, recovery support services that we talk about a lot on the addiction side in terms of drug and alcohol or even the mental health side, but it would be really nice to expand those services to people who have problem gambling issues. So thank you again for listening, talking about this issue. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions from any of these folks? I have one. So we heard from Representative Kennemer that there's been a 10% increase in the last 3 years. Does anyone want to address that? I mean, I'm hearing you say there is treatment, and we've heard that in past committee meetings, that there is treatment that's effective. I guess what I'm hearing on this committee is we would like to prevent the addiction to begin with rather than treating with treating the addiction after someone is already addicted. So can anyone give us a clue on why there has been this 10% increase?
So Chair Tomei, it may be that we want Tom Moore to speak to that. He actually does the data tracking sure. for the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling.
That's great. Thank you.
My name is Tom Moore, Wilsonville, Oregon. I hold several hats. One is I've been doing research for 17 years for the state gambling programs, and I've also done most of the major research that's been population studies been done in Oregon. The number that floats around, the last prevalence study that we did was in 2006. And so what's happened is population has increased. So we don't know if the number of problem gamblers has increased or not.
Okay. Any quick questions, Representative?
Do you have any data over problem gambling over the last 3 years? I mean, we went into a recession essentially December 2007, and sometimes what you see as a national trend with gambling is, you know, folks who get caught into it for whatever reason, thinking they're going to make the mortgage payment or thinking they're going to, you know, double what's in their pocket. What has been the trend in just the last three-year window as we've struggled economically as a state?
Well, all that we do know is the number of people coming in treatment and the number of gamblers.
Decline.
And what we've seen, and Carol can speak to the number of the revenues from the lottery. But what we've seen the numbers in both people gambling and the numbers of people coming into treatment go down. This economy is so bad that there's no way we can even make a guess of why. There's a lot of people that would theorize that the gamblers are still out there and they're still gambling and the problem is manifesting itself much more. There's other people that would say that there's some problem gamblers that might be able to control their gambling over a short period of time. We don't know. We just know something very strange is going on because of the economy.
So if historically you'd saw more treatment and treatment numbers are down, are these people who are paying treatment cash out of pocket and they don't have the cash out of pocket to pay treatment? Are there people who are getting some kind of government-sponsored treatment? Or?
There's no cost for treatment.
No cost for treatment.
Personally, what I think is the stigma associated with fear of losing one's job. Chair, forgive me for my failure in procedure here. That the stigma and the potential of losing one's job if they're discovered to be going into treatment or something like that, I think that may be playing it. We're looking at this last fiscal year's data, and this is very preliminary. We're seeing less married people coming into treatment. I don't know what that means. I need to go back and look at the data over the years and stuff like that. But again, something strange is going on within this population. I don't think the number of people and the amount of problems that we have is going down. I believe that once the economy comes back, I think we're going to have a raging number of people coming into treatment. And I can't remember the exact year. We had some budget cuts in 2003, I want to say, I could be wrong, where we saw the economy went down, we saw the same thing happen, and after that, the number of people coming into treatment just climbed 40%.
It's like a weird counter-cyclical kind of.
It is, it's very strange, and it's very difficult to predict.
Okay, thank you.
Colleagues, I would really wish that we could make this a committee bill. Do you have an interest in that? We have the potential of having five committee bills. And to me, this is an important one. I know Representative Kinnemer would work with us on this. Is there anyone else who would like to work on this issue? Representative Widener.
I was going to say, I have a land use bill. Could we make that a committee bill with this?
That really doesn't have anything much to do with social service.
It does. It really
Mike
does.
Mike Schaffler said so in the last session we were here.
Is anyone interested in working with Representative Kinnemer? Representative Parrish, wonderful. Good. Terrific.
I just wonder whether the 2012 session is the right session for something this complicated, since we'll have only a week and a half in the committee to work on the same House bill. This seems to me one that would be I'd be delighted to work on it, but it would be really ripe for 2013 if it seemed to be.
You make an excellent point. Let's talk offline to see if there's some small piece of it at least we might be able to deal with.
Well, can I just interject? Yes. I mean, I think Representative Kinnemer has brought language for this, so it's not like we'd have to be drafting something from scratch. I think he's got things from previous cycles that he's worked on that we could go back to grab draft concepts and see what he's got already done up from previous cycles.
Can you do that?
I will.
Thank you so much. Thank you, committee. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Could you make sure, Mr. Moore, I don't have any information about you. I know how to reach these two people. If you could give our staff information, we'll know how to reach you.
Certainly, Chair Tomey.
Thank you so much. With that, we'll close the committee meeting on problem gambling, open up the committee hearing on Human Services Coalition of Oregon with John Mullen. Thank you for coming, John.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen, and I'm here as a member of the leadership team of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, or HSCO as we like to call it. I'm also one of the founders of the Human Services Coalition. As some of you know, I'm in what I affectionately call my second career, working with the Oregon Law Center. Prior to that, I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services for many years, where I had the honor to work with Representative Tomei, was one of my board members going way back in the past. I'm often fond of saying about the Human Services Coalition, if we had not invented it, we would have a need to invent it because of what it does. And I want to talk a little bit about it in historical context for a moment. Going way back to the 1980s, when we first started talking about how we could work better together, the Department of Human Services didn't exist. It was called the Department of Human Resources. The Oregon Health Plan didn't exist. There were many things that were very different in those days. What was similar, as we all, those of us in Oregon, remember the 80s. The 80s were a time of really difficult issues around revenue and the need that we saw in the community. Disturbingly, though, however, we had a number of people that were working on human service issues that were not working together. So we would have instances where somebody would say, here's a program that I'm interested in for children, don't fund this program for seniors, and vice versa. At the same time, we were also concerned because we needed to tell the human services story better. When we talk, when people talk about education or they talk about public safety, almost everybody immediately knows what that means. Everybody's been to school. We all know what public safety means to a community. For human services, it's much more amorphous. So you can see from our title, we talked about the Human Services Coalition back in the days when it was the Department of Human Resources. Human Services is always a lowercase discussion for us. We're concerned about housing issues. We're concerned about things like Head Start. We even spend time down in the Revenue Committee talking about tax and revenue issues. And that's the second reason why we were created. We wanted to do the best that we could to expand the pie for human services, as we used to say back then, because we felt that the needs were really very pressing in our communities, and we wanted to be able to put the best case forward for legislators to consider. Over the years, our membership has been about 100 or so different organizations and individuals. It's gone up and down a little bit. We are coming up on our fall pledge drive, so we'll be out there beating the bushes trying to get people involved. Over the years, we've also had some very interesting people that have been involved in the Human Services Coalition. One of your own, Representative Tina Kotek, was this young advocate that I just thought was just an amazing person, and wouldn't she be a great chair of the Human Services Coalition? Well, she stayed with us for a while and went on to bigger and better things. In the room, I think, with me right now is Ryan Fisher, who's one of the current co-chairs of the Human Services Coalition, and we just have now elected a new co-chair, Liesl Wendt, from the 211 program. She's going to be taking over. Along the way, Human Services Coalition did a number of things that I thought were really terrific. I'm really proud of the organization and the work that we did. We at one point in time had a video that we did that played on PBS, and we had a whole big reception for that. We worked in the late 80s and the early 90s to create an organization called the Heart of Oregon that went around educating people community by community about the tax system in the state of Oregon. So we got very familiar with the ins and outs of tax issues. These days, we spend a lot of time talking about tax expenditures down in the Revenue Committee, for example. We also did a number of white papers where we talked about human services. We've done a number of things over the years that I feel really very good about. And these days, I feel especially good about the leadership and the future that we have. To me, for somebody that I've spent now 36 odd years working in this in the human services field, broadly speaking, and to me, to see young advocates coming up in the world and they have this interest in talking about human services, what it means to communities, how nonprofits are involved, how government's involved, how volunteers are involved to make this all work. And doing it with the sense that goes back to our bedrock issues that are the fact that we will not talk poorly about another program and say you ought to cut this program. Many times I've been sitting in a seat like this and a legislator will ask me, well, you make a decision about what it is that you want to fund. And the Human Services Coalition doesn't do that. That's not our role. But that's not to say that individual members don't come and appear at your door and advocate as hard as they can about the issues that they're concerned in about, and that's perfectly fine. What we just want to make sure is that nobody is coming to your door and saying, gee, my program is better than this other program, you ought to cut that one. Because we feel fundamentally that's a disservice to not only the coalition, but a disservice to your own decision-making about how to set those kind of priorities. We are always interested to put the needs in front of you and talk about what the choices are. And in that context, of course, we're coming to a very difficult time. We're in the midst of a very difficult time, in many ways reminiscent of what we experienced just budget-wise in the early 80s when the resources were very bleak. I would point out that during the 80s, some of the things that we did were really very inspiring and important, like the whole creation of the long-term care system that figured out a way to spend less money but improve services. And so we're always interested in ways in which systems can operate more efficiently, operate better. We've been partners, for example, with the Department of Human Services as they've taken a look at ways in which they could streamline their systems. Because ultimately, we want to see the state agencies succeed, we want to see people succeed in the communities, and we want to do that in the most effective and efficient manner possible. I have a handout which explains a little bit about our mission statement, and in addition, in this almost paperless world, we managed to cram everything that you needed to know about last session on one page, which you all received at the end of session, and talking about what the issues were, what we faced in the session, what we thought were the successes, and what we thought were some of the challenges ahead.
Did you give us a handout today, John?
It's in the packet. Mm-hmm. Chair Tomei.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes. Representative Thompson.
This is open-ended, and you're not going to answer it today probably, but you've been involved in the health care transformation process like many of us. What are your thoughts on the lines between community health care and community services and how we make this whole thing work at a community level?
Co-chairs, Representative Thompson, that's an excellent question, and I have a personal feeling about that as well as the way the Human Services Coalition looked at that. Back in the 2009 session when House Bill 2009 was passed, one of the things that we talked about was our concern about the splitting up of the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. We were concerned to make sure that there was going to be ongoing collaboration between those two entities. We formed a stakeholder group and we talked about those issues even as the separation was happening and came up with a number of recommendations. One of our recommendations is that we continue to monitor and discuss with both departments about how to do a better job collaborating on behalf of low-income people and vulnerable people. Now, specifically, as far as healthcare transformation is concerned, my personal bias about it, I was involved in administering the long-term care system in Clackamas County, as well as the Community Action Agency, Area Agency on Aging Programs, Housing, Transportation, Volunteer Services. If community care, coordinated care organizations are going to succeed, if transformation is going to succeed, it's going to involve everybody working together. And that's a challenge because, as you know, Representative Thompson, House Bill 3650, the long-term care programs are not part of the funding mechanism, but I don't see how long-term care can be separated from that discussion. And indeed, to succeed for people who have dual and triple eligibility, the area agencies on aging, the senior and people with disability offices are going to have to be engaged in it. Because as you all very well know, transformation envisions saving money, which is going to be a great challenge. And to make that work and to get to that real person-centered way in which we're looking at care, we're going to need to have everybody pulling together. So I think it's a challenging but exciting time. And I really thank you for that question. And thank you and others who have worked on this about your interest in trying to figure out how to do that well, because ultimately I think that's going to be one of the big challenges that we have, not only because of our finances, but demographically how we're changing in Oregon.
Follow up?
Yeah. And I bring this up, and I know it's a big subject, but I recently became aware of a situation of an elderly woman living alone, again, isolated, who developed some very serious health care problems. Turns out the whole root of it was isolation and poor nutrition. And I'm beginning to look at this from a standpoint of maybe we need to talk about community care integration more than siloing health care as something that happens when we didn't do something else. And maybe some of these vulnerable populations, we've got to have a more extended view. We'll talk more about that.
I certainly agree.
Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chan, I'd like to probe a little bit on what you said about the coalition not saying what to fund and what not to fund. As you know, I had the painful experience of trying to help make those decisions over the last two sessions. And I was impressed by the community college budgeting situation where the 17 community colleges get together and determine a priority level for their all of their requests. And it's been very successful for them in helping them get more money for all the programs, I believe, because there's not the competition. You want to go back and talk about whether if your coalition can't prioritize needs better than anybody else, the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the Ways and Means Committee, anybody else, then I'm misunderstanding what the process is. And I mean, you might help the whole field by helping us create the priorities made by the people who know best what the priorities really are.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick, that's kind of a perennial question that we get, and we have at times taken positions on things. For example, when there's streamlining or administrative cuts to make, those are of course among the lower hanging fruit. They're easier to talk about those things. But we also took positions that don't necessarily have unanimity. For example, the whole idea of engaging in the healthcare discussion and involving what became known as the SAFE Coalition back in 2009. Human Services Coalition took a position to support that, even though there were members of our group that didn't agree. But the nature of a coalition and being a broad coalition, we know that there are going to be discussions that happen within subgroups, like the Mental Health Association, of course, is involved with us. There's discussion that happened in that area about how to prioritize mental health. The discussion that goes around healthcare, Care Oregon, for example, is part of our group. And there's discussion that happened in the healthcare field about how to narrow those discussions and how to prioritize. But by the nature of what it is that we do, we're not going to say one service is better than another or more important than another, even though we get asked that. We do, though, talk to decision makers and say, here's somebody that you need to talk to understand this issue better. If it's a question about, well, what's the value of long-term care, for example. We can have one of our members come and talk to people about that. But I definitely agree. One of our famous co-chairs, who's no longer with us, Jerry Bieberly, who's been dead 10 years now. It's amazing to think about. He died in August of 2001. When he was co-chair, he was a little bit more brusque than I tend to be. Legislators would ask that question. He says, that's why you ran for office, to make those decisions. And I wouldn't say it quite that directly.
Then the answer is, then stop whining about how we made the decision.
Well, in fact, I think if you look at our end of session report, I think it's a productive discussion about, here's some things that we think that happened well, and here's some things that we're going to be interested in doing. I mean, advocates are never going to be, advocates will always be with us, and we will be back at everybody's door saying, here's something we would like you to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. It's always good to see you. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll give you back the gavel.
I neglected
to.
Go ahead.
Close the public informational hearing on Human Services Coalition of Oregon.
Did she wreck it before she handed it back?
Oh, no, it's great. It's warm. I told Lou that we would take a moment for a couple of announcements. So if it's okay with you, I'll call on him now.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Both chairs there, co-chairs. I have two announcements, and I just wanted to acknowledge two months that are coming. One's coming up, one we're in the middle of. Recovery from alcohol and drug, as well as mental health issues. Recovery Month is taking place right now. There are a lot of people out there who are hard at work trying to do that, both personally and to help those who are struggling to do that. I would encourage you to find the agencies that are involved in that and see if you can help them. That's one. And then in October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And I would encourage you to also get involved with that for next month. It's just two things that we hear about them all the time, but I just wanted to make sure that people knew about them. So
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. The next item in our informational meeting is court-appointed special advocates. And if you're here to testify on that, I invite you up. Identify for the record and feel free to begin.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Pam Fortier, and I am the director of CASA Central Oregon, serving Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties, and I'm also the president of the Oregon CASA Network. And I'd like to also introduce Barbara Johnson. She is the director of Clackamas County, and she serves as the chair of our allocation work group, and she's also a member of the CASA task force. So with that as part of our update, I'm going to go back to January and just kind of give a quick overview of what started in the first of the year. So in January, the Oregon CASA Directors Network voted to form a nonprofit membership corporation. And the Oregon CASA Network was selected as the name of this new corporation by the directors. In March, the articles of incorporation were filed. And in June, we had our first Oregon CASA Network organizational meeting. Board members were elected, and bylaws and a memorandum of agreement were adopted. The Oregon CASA Network is a provisional member of National CASA, and I want to point out that it's advantageous for us to be a part of this, a member of the National CASA, as we can leverage the work and resources done across the United States. Our board consists of six members, five are directors of local programs, and one is a community member. The organizational structure of the Oregon CASA Network consists of five committees, governance, finance, legislative, audit, and executive. And the committees are comprised of board members, program directors, and community members. The strength of the Oregon CASA Network comes from the membership of the local programs. In addition to the committees, we also have four work groups assigned to committees. And the work groups are overall coordination, allocation, resource development, and quality assurance. A quality assurance policy will be ready to roll out late fall or the first of 2012. An on-site audit is under development to assure the success of each local program in providing optimal services to the children mandated to serve while providing professional support to the volunteer advocates. The process also ensures that local CASA programs are operating within the guidelines and policies set forth by National CASA and the Oregon CASA Network. The quality assurance policy is intended to support the Oregon CASA Network mission to strengthen and support local programs. Through compliance, local programs can achieve higher standards of performance, fiscal and volunteer management, and benefit from the efficiencies that can be gained through consistency and utilization of best practices throughout the Oregon CASA Network. Financial systems and practices are currently being reviewed for adoption that will allow the Oregon CASA Network to accept, track, and disperse donations and grants, and that can pass scrutiny of state, federal, and private funder requirements. While my presentation is fairly short, I think you can see in the last months that we have really accomplished a lot. And I want to extend my appreciation for having this opportunity to share our work.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, this is Barbara Johnson. I didn't have anything specific to add as a member of the CASA Task Force. We're anxiously awaiting the convening and hope to have some information soon to bring back to you. And, hopefully we'll have a new home for CASA to live within the administration of state government in Oregon. And if you have any questions, we're happy to address them.
Thank you for being here, and I would just echo, we too are eager for the task force. One of the things we do in this building is form lots of work groups and task forces, and I would caution the committee, if you ever push a bill that has a task force in it, it's likely that you'll be put on that task force. And I think the governor's office is a little backed up with assignments, but I am assured they're getting there. I'm working on one now, our Elder Abuse Task Force, and I know they've had a backlog of doing that. So we look forward to that as well. I appreciate the quick update, and we look forward to something more substantive after the task force has met. But before we close out, Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to check because you guys are very, very important, and I know you're homeless right now, but hopefully that'll be taken care of here shortly. But with you forming your own corporation and everything, or getting set up as an individual, will you be able to assign the money that flows into CASA? Because I know right now it's kind of dispersed with counties and populations rather than where the heavy caseloads are. Are you going to be able to make those adjustments, or will that be still dealt with at the state level? Because I know there's some issues there that we probably should be dealing with.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, we have over the years during different sessions had an allocation committee that's made up of members of our different CASA programs that work on that and bring recommendations to our group as a whole, who in the past when we were with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families made that recommendation to them, and they of course have the authority to make that final decision, but they always adopted the recommendation that we made. We are in the process of looking at different ways to do that. Unfortunately, as I'm sure you hear from so many different people that come to testify, the amount of our funding is so small that it's really challenging to divide that meaningfully, 36 counties, 30 different programs, in a way that supports all of our programs. So our goal has always been both to keep a CASA program and CASA services in every county while focusing on those counties with the greatest need. And frankly, it's a challenge, and we continue to look at that, and we have a committee now that is in the process of trying to come up with a different allocation formula than we currently have to try and address that a little more in a more meaningful and hopefully better way so that we can serve more children. That's always our fundamental goal.
If I may follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you. I mean, just from CASAs in the field that I've talked to and worked with, I know, like some of them were saying, we have twice the caseload out here in this county, and then you have Lake Oswego, the county where none of us can afford to live, receiving more funds, and they may have a third to of the clients, or 75% less than some of the other districts. So I think that'd be the thing to really look at on how you dispense some people in the areas.
So. Yeah. Again, co-chairs and Representative Widener, as I said originally when we looked at our formula, the original funding for CASA that was and the directive from the legislature was to expand CASA statewide, and we did that. But with that, in order to have a program in every county, it requires some level of funding, and that takes money away, if you will, from programs that have more children in greater need. So we're in the process of looking at possibly regionalizing some programs. For instance, CASA of Central Oregon used to be three separate programs. Now they have one administration and three counties that they serve. And as with everything else, that brings its own set of problems. So our committee, our allocation committee, is made up of directors from small programs, from large programs, from programs with, you know, growing need. And we are trying to look at that. If you'd like to join our committee and bring some more insight and another perspective, we'd be happy to have you. I'm sure you have a lot of spare time, and I'm only being slightly facetious there. You know, we're always looking for people with other ideas to help us out. So we are looking at that, but to say that I think we'll have anything in the short term, we're also trying to coordinate with the task force and see what that's going to look like and what difference that will make for us as well. So it is something that our members always bring up, and we are trying to address.
Mr. Chair, if I may finish this, just to warn them. Sure. Last time I went to create a task force, it was to study nuclear engineering, and then we had a huge problem in Japan, I believe it was, with an earthquake and things like that. So I quickly threw that bill away, so you may not want me to be on a task force or generate one for you.
Point taken. Thank you.
Chair, do you have a word?
I do. I have a series of questions, if I might. So how many CASAs are there throughout the state?
You know, I did not come with that number.
That's okay.
Me.
Maybe you can get it for us another time.
Yeah, I can send that too.
And it is in all counties. Is that what I heard? And what proportion of children who could use CASAs have them? Do you have any sense of that?
Again, I have those numbers, but I did not bring those with me.
That's fine. And how, if you can get them to us.
Yeah, I will.
And how do you recruit CASAs?
That actually, from program to program, one through National CASA, there is a website. So like Dr. Phil has been actually a huge proponent of CASA and has had public service announcements throughout the state of Oregon, well, and across the nation. And for my program, whenever those play, a lot of folks, then they go to National CASA, and then they automatically link into your own program. And so that's one way that we recruit. We're also looking at statewide, where we can benefit the entire network, is having a marketing campaign and a community awareness campaign for recruiting volunteers. And National CASA is just right now rolling out I Am a Child, or a For the Child campaign. And so we do use that partnership a lot in our recruitment.
Chair Comey, if I could add, programs also, for instance, use websites, we use social media, we use articles in local newspapers and other media outlets, we, CASAs and staff speak at community organizations, we ask our CASA volunteers to help recruit other people, so they come from a variety of places within each of our communities.
Thank you. I hope, Mr. Chair, I know Representative Thompson is on the task force, and we'll be hearing from you in a few months. And I think this committee has a lot of interest in this program. Yeah. I think we want to support as much as possible. So I look forward to hearing from the committee.
And
Before we get to Representative Thompson, just for clarification for Dr. Greenlich, when she referred to Dr. Phil, it was the television personality, not Dr. Barnhart. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Well, it's very helpful. I mean, now that I know you're an expert at causing elder abuse, you're not only picking on me, you're picking on another elder, and I'm a mandatory reporter.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's absolutely true.
Representative Thompson.
A couple of questions. We'll get into a lot of this stuff in the committee work coming up. How is there a formula for allocation, or is it based on last year's budget, or how do you deal? Yeah, you may not be on the allocation committee. I don't know, but
well,
how do you deal with it, and how much general fund money goes in there?
I can speak in close to the real number generalities. CASA is allocated a little over, I think the last number was $2.6 million before the most recent cuts per biennium.
Get ready for February, by the way.
Right, right. So that money, the current allocation formula has two minimum grants, one for the smallest programs, and then there's another minimum grant. If you want those actual numbers, we'd be happy to provide those. I don't have them off the top of my head. And above that, the funds that are available above that go to the counties based on 0 to 18 population. And that's how it has always been allocated. And there have been concerns expressed that as the numbers of children, as the need grows in some communities, that we need to look at reallocating the money in a different way. And we have looked at that. But so far, we have maintained that the same allocation formula, because when we looked at the numbers with such a small amount of money, in order to keep the smaller counties continuing to have a program, frankly, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference when you have a limited number of funds to divide in that many ways already. So, but we continue to look at that, and our goal is to serve more children. So we are looking at both lowering the minimum grant and adding a requirement that programs raise some percentage of matching funds. I mean, most of our programs are nonprofits, and they raise $3 or $4 for every state dollar they get. So, but I'm not sure that all of our programs do that. So those are the number of things that we're looking at to try and address that and make it more equitable and serve more children.
Yeah, I noticed that, picking up on what Representative Widener was talking about, there is a huge disparity between counties. And Clackamas County, I think the latest numbers I have, was allocated $95,000. But Douglas County, the same number of foster children, was allocated $36,000. And I'm assuming that's because you have absolutely excellent representation in the House for Clackamas County.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure that would just, be part
it's
of
it's
it.
It's a sort of, you know, there, yeah. And it's not just it, singling out you, but looking at counties from county to county, it's like, wow, where'd that number come from? Because they're not anywhere. I don't understand the mechanism that gets those numbers. So.
Okay, and again, it's population. So it is historically, part of our challenge is that the children that CASA is charged with advocating for is not exactly equal to children in foster care. So our charge is slightly larger than that. It's all children who have a dependency petition filed. Okay. So it's roughly equal. And as those numbers have gotten, as there's been more disparity and larger numbers in some counties, again, that's why we have been looking at that, and we continue to try to find a way to get the money where the greatest need is and the most children needing advocates.
I think for lack of time, most of my questions can be dealt with in a later meeting.
Okay. Are there other comments or questions before we move on? Thank you both for coming.
Thank
and
you.
We'll look forward to the continued work, particularly with the task force coming. The next item on our informational meeting is Oregon Commission on Children and Families. We're going to get an update from Iris Bell.
It's not, I just picked those up.
Oh, good.
Thank Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Iris Bell, and I am the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, as well as the Interim Transition Director for the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And I'm here this afternoon to give you an update on the activities of the commission, the State Commission, as a result of the passage of Senate Bill 909. So as you know, Senate Bill 909 established the Oregon Education Investment Board as well as the Early Learning Council. And the Early Learning Council has basically been charged with doing an analysis of all the programs for early childhood services in state government. It also, Senate Bill 909, also transferred the duties of the State Commission to the Oregon Education Investment Board and to the Early Learning Council. As a result of that transition, and as a result of the legislature actually eliminating the executive director of the State Commission, we are due to sunset in June 30th, 2012. We have met with the governor, and when I say we, I mean Dick Withnell, who's the chair of our commission, and Jean Phelps, who's the vice chair of our commission. We have met with the governor, and the governor has given us some assignments and to make some recommendations to his office, as well as to the Oregon Education Investment Board, about how to sort of disperse with, transfer, eliminate, and coordinate the programs and initiatives and the funding streams of the commission. So what we have done is we've formed several work groups, and these work groups have been working. They've started their work this September. We formed several work groups to begin to make recommendations to the governor and to the Oregon Education Investment Board about the programs, initiatives, and funding streams of the commission. Those recommendations will go to the governor in November. And as a result of those recommendations going to the governor in November, we will then begin to work on our continuity plan, our transition continuity plan for the State Commission. In the meantime, though, we have adopted some goals and are still continuing to work with the 36 local commissions in terms of supporting them as they look at this transition and the impact of this transition on their local communities. Along the lines of the goals, we have taken a look at early childhood development and early learning, child abuse and neglect prevention, child hunger, and juvenile crime. And those we're trying to align with the governor's priorities as we move forward. We are also continuing to do work in the State Commission office. We still have our focus on the safe and equitable reduction of foster care, and we're looking at that particular initiative, which is the Casey Initiative, with respect to how to ensure that you continue to have community engagement at the community level in those in that particular program. We still have our juvenile crime prevention program.
Go back for just a second. Pardon me for interrupting. When you say the Casey Initiative, you're talking about the Casey Foundation?
Yes.
Can you say just a little bit more about that for members that may not know?
Okay. Well, for those who do not know, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, along with the Department of Human Services and the Judicial Department, are engaged in an initiative with Casey Family Programs, looking at the safe and equitable reduction of foster care and looking at how to reduce the numbers of children who are in foster care, keeping those children safe, and also looking at the disproportionate number of kids of color who are in the foster care system. And so the Casey Family Programs have brought in some funding and support resources to help and assist us in that endeavor. Along those lines, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families component, a major work, has been in the area of the community engagement and bringing together community teams in communities to support the effort. And so there are teams working out in various counties and various communities around the state on looking at reducing those numbers of kids in foster care in their particular communities. And I believe that what we've done is we've taken a look at the highest numbers of kids in counties and began to focus on those initially. So that work is continuing on, and we are continuing to work and supporting the engagement in the community at the local level and bringing partners together to do that particular work. In addition to that, we are working, continuing to work with our juvenile crime prevention program, both our Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and our Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. So those two committees are still operating and we're still moving forward. We still have our Healthy Start and our Relief Nursery programs. Healthy Start program is very involved in the home visiting component of work that we're working on with several other state agencies at the moment as well. And you've heard about from the CASA folks this afternoon and the fact that there's a task force that has been formed for CASA. CASA's home continues to be at the State Commission office. We are right now going to be serving as the fiscal agent to the task force, and so at some point we will wait to hear what that means and wait to hear from them in terms of their needs. Our homeless and runaway youth program did transfer over to the Department of Human Services as of June 30th of this year. So that particular program has already transferred over and is in another state agency. So what we're doing now as we work on these various components of the state office and the state commission is beginning to get ready and prepare for the recommendations to the governor and to prepare for a plan, a continuity plan, a transition plan that would go to the legislature in February. So that is the kind of work that we're doing right now in terms of the state office and the state commission.
Changing times.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for that update. Are there questions for our guest? Seeing none, we thank you for coming today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Transitions there. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Harry.
One last item on our informational meeting, Manager.
All right. The Children of Elton Family Update. Erin Kelly Seal. Hello, Erin.
Hello.
Are you
Good
coming
afternoon.
Up alone today?
Pardon?
Are you coming up alone today?
I am, and it's the end of a beautiful week, apparently the last day of summer, and I feel like it's just going to be Mickey and I and all of you. So
sounds good.
For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I think I have appeared before you since I changed positions. I was formerly known as the Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and I'm now the Director of the Department of Human Services. That took effect in April. So I had two items that the co-chairs asked me to speak with you all about today, just in the form of an update. One was about some changes that are happening within the Department of Human Services as we transition to becoming a new agency. And the second issue was just a brief update on kind of a segue from the conversation about Casey Family Programs, a brief update on some of our additional strategies to safely reduce foster care through a new model of service delivery. So first, around the organization, I did bring copies for you of a draft organizational chart that I'm currently soliciting feedback on, so if you all have feedback for me today, I welcome that, or later on. So if you, for those of you who've served or have been in Oregon for a long period of time, you know that this agency has gone through many expansion and contraction efforts over time. There was a point in time that the Department of Human Services actually included the Employment Division, for example. It also included the Oregon Youth Authority. And so it is not uncommon for us to change our shape and structure, although it is something that we take very seriously because we are a large, complex organization and we provide life-sustaining services to people. So never would we want to disrupt our ability to provide service. We would only want to enhance it as we evolve. Most recently in House Bill 2009, which did happen to pass in 2009, which is helpful for me, helps me remember it, you chose to divide the health programs that had previously resided in the Department of Human Services from the remainder of the human service programs and then add to those in the Oregon Health Authority, as you know, several other health insurance-related programs creating the Oregon Health Authority. And most of the discussion for the last biennium has been about the health authority and what it would look like and how it would evolve. And really, the Department of Human Services, until it got its own director, was a little bit limited in its ability to have that conversation. We have become smaller. We no longer include as many programs as we once did, public health, addictions and mental health services, and our administration for Oregon Health Plan policy and program has moved over to the Oregon Health Authority. So we've been spending the last several months looking at a couple of things. We started with a conversation about really what it is that we do and what are our overarching goals as an organization, and almost more important, but I didn't want to overwhelm you with paper. I know you're primarily electronic, and I'd be happy. I will send the link to your staff and make sure that you have this. Are two other documents that were published at the same time in draft form as the organizational chart. One is a management map, and the second is an overall agency scorecard. These two things represent for us an effort to make different this particular phase of our evolution than the last. In the last evolution of the agency, there was a lot of conversation about the boxes and where people sat, and less discussion about how we manage and run the organization in order to accomplish particular goals. This time, we've identified as a leadership team overarching goals for the entire enterprise, and we've spent some time figuring out what are the data measurements that we are going to be reporting on to you and to the public to show that we're actually achieving those results. We've also taken time to identify what it is that we do, and not just from the perspective of a particular program, but across all programs in the agency, what is the basic core fundamental functionality of the Department of Human Services, and how is it that we get there? So in those other documents, you'll see a definition of the different types of work that happens in the department and exactly the steps that are comprised of that type of work. You'll see process and outcome measures that we've prioritized, and you'll see names of people in the agency who are those process owners. So you will know to whom you want to go if you want to hear more from us about business partnership. That's one of our key strategic goals, is to be a strong business partner. I think you know that, yes, it is true. We administer and deliver service directly as a state agency, but about 90% of our funding goes out in the form of payments to clients and or payments to providers in order for them to provide the service. That requires of us a business model that says we value our partnerships with the community, we value the business relationship and rapport we have with those providers, and we want to make sure that we're managing that relationship and its working elements effectively. So you'll see all those things, and that was the time we took primarily to define our functionality and our key goals. We took the time to do that before we got to the conversation about the organizational chart. There are not really significant changes in the boxes of the chart itself. The most notable you'll see is we no longer have a Children, Adults, and Families division or a Seniors and People with Disabilities division. Instead, we're organizing ourselves by major program areas, and so I effectively will not have deputies under me who administer those divisions, but I will have five directors of those program areas. And this is really critically important, you'll see in the boxes, along with those directors, we're evolving, I think, in our maturity operationally. We're creating joint accountability and responsibility for programs across the design and implementation of a program, the delivery on the ground of the program, and also then the operational supports for the program. So you'll see Jerry Raybrandt and Tricia Baxter's name, for example, appear in multiple boxes. They are the chief operating officers for those programs. They provide the perspective on delivery and operations and are jointly accountable with the program directors for the results that I'm expecting and that you're expecting of us. They're also providing the connection across programs that have and will continue to have connection, like self-sufficiency in child welfare and developmental disability programs and aging and physical disability programs. So we've put in place in the infrastructure some different things than we've had before. We're also asking questions about consolidation. Not only have we gotten smaller in terms of the programs that we've been asked to administer, but we've also gotten smaller as a result of the budget climate these last several years. We have many fewer staff to do this work, and our old model and structure depended on staffing capacities that are no longer present. So, and that's primarily in our central supports and services. We talk a lot with your committee about our delivery and our workload model and our staffing levels on the ground in branch offices in your communities. What I'm really talking about here is that centrally, as you all know, in terms of functions that are really supporting the business, we have been in a hiring freeze for the last almost four years. And so our capacity has dwindled, the expectations have risen, our need for continuous improvement continues, and really part of this effort around consolidation is to be sure that we are aligning and prioritizing appropriately the work so that we can get those results that we're all striving for. And so the key to this model is that we're going to do that with the client or customer primarily in mind. So you'll see the little triangle in the top left-hand corner. That's an attempt by me, a very rudimentary attempt by me to describe that the client is always our focus and that everyone is jointly accountable for results. So we don't want to have a conversation with you that's about our field infrastructure and how they're doing without also talking about how the program is supporting their work and how our budget and our HR department and our IT department are supporting their work. They're all integral to our ability to achieve the results for clients. So that's a little glimpse into how the evolution of the department is moving. We have a pretty fast, we're only 12 months old. Or 12 weeks old, I should say. We became a new agency on July 1st. So I feel like we've accomplished quite a bit. And when you look at these management maps, you're welcome to provide us feedback as well. And you'll also see our first scorecard. We had our first quarterly business review in July. We'll have on.
Yes, Representative Greenlick.
On the organization. It looks like you have about, I think it's 18 direct reports. And most management theorists would suggest that that's quite a few for a professional.
That's what?
That's a very large number of reports for professional work or high-level management work. Yeah, I mean, I know you used to be all those 18 jobs yourself at the same time, but...
I guess she'll agree with you.
Well, I mean, starting out with a table organization that sets you up for perhaps problems, I mean, you might want to reconsider.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick, I appreciate your concern for my sanity. I share it. It is a conversation. Okay, for my efficacy, my effectiveness. Sorry, that was about me. I slipped out of testimony mode for just a moment.
You know who you're talking to here? Sanity? I mean, there's none.
You know, that point's been raised about this, and I appreciate it for a couple of reasons. You know, really not about me, but about the people that I'm supporting. They need to be adequately supported. I think one of the things that I'm attempting to do before I address that issue is first really redefine the positions themselves and focus on what it is I'm expecting of them. And so I've recently gone through the process of updating the position descriptions for all of the directors, as well as we're doing work on this concept of the chief operating officer, which is a new concept for us. When I complete that and I'm able to really see how much capacity is needed by them and what it is that, you know, we're all clear and on the same page about what they do. So for instance, if you want to talk about child welfare in the future, you're most likely going to have Lois Day and Jerry Weybrandt here, not myself. That's not to say that I wouldn't welcome the opportunity I always do to be in front of a committee, but a lot of the things that I used to do as the director of CAF are now going to be transferred to people other than me. Some of that outward-facing work, the work that we do in partnership with our stakeholder groups, the work we do in partnership with our federal partners. So I haven't been able to really evaluate yet how hard is it, how hard is the structure on the director, does the director need some additional assistance in terms of reports until I really get those new job descriptions in place and actually people in the positions doing the work. That's another significant issue. I have two major vacancies right now. So one step at a time, this won't be final, but we are aiming to really finalize as much of the decisions that are outstanding as we can by December, because of course we're continuing to run the agency. We come back in February to be with you and provide you reports on a multitude of initiatives and issues. We've got budget challenges that are also influencing these conversations, and so there's other work that we need to be doing. So it's that balance between taking the time to get it right, but also, you know, aggressively moving toward decisions so that staff have as little uncertainty as possible for as minimal time as possible.
There's some monumental changes here in this agency.
Chair Tomei, you know, I think there are changes less... I think Two things. One, we've been moving toward this, I think, for a while, the lean daily management and continuous improvement work that we've been doing, the leadership model, some of the things we've been doing to better support the professional development of our staff. I think of this a little bit as an agency wellness plan. It's hard to create new habits, but before now, we've had a management infrastructure that I think, quite frankly, was dependent upon the person in charge. And what I'm attempting to do is to really create some cohesion in a structure so that it's not person-dependent. It's intentional. You can see it very transparently on our webpage exactly how we run and who's responsible for what. I've had the experience of stepping into one of these high-level positions, and nobody gave me a handbook. There was nothing to tell me, you know, how it is that the business was actually run and operated. And this is a conversation that a lot of private agencies are going through, private entities are going through as well. It's not just a challenge for the public sector. The process we've been going through is one that a couple of other state agencies have been going through as well. And that's encouraging to me because I think you'll have a common language among your state agency heads about how to talk to us with respect to, you know, are we getting the results that you want? It takes concepts that you've had in place for a while, like key performance measures for programs, and really embeds them into the discussion about how the work gets done, both the day-to-day work and the strategic efforts. And I think it's going to help us prioritize. I know that that's going to be the focus of our discussion because of the budget environment. It has been for the last several biennia. I think this will equip us better to do that. So the change is more operational, I think, than it is structural. The field infrastructure is not changing. The people who do the work on the ground with clients will feel very little of this, if anything, except that hopefully they'll feel better supported by those of us centrally who, for whom, you know, they really are our primary customers.
Well, I hope you will continue coming back to this committee and updating us.
Sure.
Let us know how all of this is working. And when you send the management map and the scorecard, could you send it with the heading that according to our meeting today, because we all get so many
Sure.
emails, and I want to make sure that we are able to look at that so that it makes some sense to according to the presentation today. Any questions? Representative Wagner.
Yeah, may I real quick? Just, I want to go back on one thing that you touched on here. You said you've had a reduction over the last 4 years. What's the reduction been?
I don't have that number off the top of my head. One of the challenges about getting it, I mean, I could tell you the budget reduction levels each biennium. Of course, last biennium, you know, we had about a 6.5% reduction in services and supplies, and that's not post-it notes, that's actual rent. Those are, you know, hard payments that we have. And then in terms of personnel, we had overarchingly a 5% reduction. And then on top of that, we have the 3.5% set aside. So I can get you some incremental budget numbers and what that's looked like going backward. And I can also attempt to show you in terms of positions what that's looked like. The challenge I have is that I've got to do that in a way, and I hope you'll accept this, that also shows the increasing caseload. I think you've heard from me before that all of this is happening at a time where we've actually earned monumental numbers of staff. So I'll give you one example. Between the 07 and 09 biennium, we earned and were given by the legislature about 500 additional positions attributable to caseload growth for our service delivery out in the field in the branches. We did not receive a single additional support person for those 500 additional staff in the field. So we added capacity for delivery, which is a priority and is really important, but I didn't get any additional resource for IT, for HR, for program, for budget management, and it just over time, that's exactly what's been happening, is that our infrastructure has stayed the same while the caseload and the programs have been growing. So I'll do my best to capture that for you, but we've been in a hard hiring freeze centrally for many years and have not been filling positions except unless there's an absolute emergency. So we've got many vacancies.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
Just wondering how much of that is transferred over to the Oregon Health Authority, because I know you had a lot of responsibilities before the Oregon Health Authority came into play here 4 years ago, and that's been taken over, and they've been hiring a tremendous amount of people on the Health Authority side. So have they been taking some of the workload from your department, or
Our department continues to have the primary responsibility around medical eligibility because for those populations, the decision, the policy decision, which is the right decision for clients, was to maintain a no wrong door so that you could come into any of our offices and find out if you were eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, the TANF program, the food stamp program, long-term care services, developmental disability services. So we will maintain, well, that's a little different because we work with counties and brokerages, but we will continue to maintain that philosophy. We did have one processing center that processed only applications for the Oregon Health Plan. It had about 250 staff, and that group of eligibility staff went over to the Oregon Health Authority. So we now share responsibility, but 80% of the work on the Oregon Health Plan in terms of front door eligibility happens through my organization, not through the Oregon Health Authority. So we're still the front door. Other than that, when we split the two agencies apart, we made a commitment to a shared services model administratively. So on the org chart, you'll see over on that right-hand side the dotted line, and you can see some different functions there. Those are functions and people that I share with the Oregon Health Authority. So we didn't duplicate administration when we split into two agencies. We've created memorandum of understanding, service level agreements, and we're sharing our budgets are designed around a shared services model now that affords those staff, and they are serving both entities. Did I answer your question?
That actually goes into it. I mean, it's one of those that until you start looking into it and what services are provided, where there's duplication, things like that, are we overstaffed possibly in the Oregon Health Authority that could alleviate some of the burden and give you more resources to do what you need to do or vice versa, and that's kind of where I was going with it. So, mm-hmm. And those are some things that we need to look at on the budget committee as well, because we might be able to use our dollars a little more efficiently, because it sounds like you're doing most of the work up front, and then they're just administering it after you've determined eligibility for someone.
Well, the nice thing, co-chairs, thank you, Representative Widener, the nice thing about the management map, for me, is that I think it will show you exactly what it is that is entailed in actually running the business of human services in a really transparent way. It's important and most important that we spend a lot of time talking about how Oregonians interface with us, and that's really important, and we strive for excellence around that. But I think we've spent a little less time talking about how are we excellent in our operational, in our business model. And I think you would expect of me as, the chief executive of a multi-billion dollar organization to be able to tell you exactly how I run and how I know that I'm running efficiently. When you look at the scorecard, you will see some red, yellow, green. So obviously red is bad. Green would be good. There's more red than green right now. And it's actually been really refreshing for our team to be able to have some really frank discussions about what data it is that we need. I think one of the misnomers is that government doesn't measure things. We actually measure probably more things than we need to measure. The question we're asking ourselves is, do we measure the right things? One of the stories that we've learned as we've been looking into our data process and our reports is that we had a report that was running because somebody 20 years ago who's now retired asked for that report. And so we're now, really taking a fresh look at what data do we actually need? What is it that tells us that we're serving people effectively? And really trying to prioritize those things. There's a lot of information and data that we've got. It's hard to tease it out of our 30-year-old data infrastructure, but it's there. So you'll see on the scorecard that we're red in some places. There's some places where we're still evolving the data point so that we can, when we have the conversation, it's really designed on around what data do you need to manage the program. And sometimes when we have the discussion about what is this telling us, why, what do we do with that information, how do we improve it if we're not at where we want to be, we find that we aren't maybe measuring the right thing and we're refining that. So I hope you'll accept this as a bit of an evolutionary process and engage with us on it and help us do it right. I think the more people who are thinking about this and who care about these issues, the better. So,
thank you. Representative Thompson.
Eric, could you get Eric Moore or somebody to put dollar numbers on these boxes? One of the things I'm thinking about, and about your agency and others is we have these inordinately large budgets, and we've got a crash coming in February that I think a positive approach is it could be a catastrophe. And it's very easy to look, and I hear these conversations at an agency like DHS say, well, they've got billions, let's just take a whack out of there, you know, 10%, whatnot. But what is that? And ways and means people are probably a better understanding, but I think most of us don't see how much dollars you pass through as checks to clients, for instance, versus the relatively few dollars that are allocated to these functions. And when my guess is, when we really get into this, there's not as much, well, you'd argue there's none, but there's not as much available money to reach in there and grab as the total budget or perceived size of the agency might dictate.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, I see, you know, on your 17 AAAs, I have no idea what's that cost? You know, and how much money do we have in that? And then we have to start talking about things like, do we need them all? We probably do. I wouldn't question that. But we need to get a better handle on where the money is and where it could or could not be reduced as we go down the road here.
Co-chairs, Representative Thompson, just for my clarification, so when you talk about the money in the boxes, are you talking about it effectively sort of administrative resources or also program resources and let's say...
What does one of these boxes cost?
Sure.
You know, and what portion of that is money that gets passed through the box to clients versus how much is the money that is staff and buildings and that kind of stuff? I really, you know, can't get into minutia, but... just an overall sense of how the dollars flow in these big budgets, because this does not look like an extremely complicated organization chart. I've seen corporations far more deeper than that. But, I know we're going to have the conversation about cutting budgets in February, and we don't have a lot of areas we can cut in that we have access to. And I think it's going to be inordinately important that we understand where these dollars are going, and particularly in case of dollars that show up in your total budget, but they're really dollars that were paid out to clients.
Yes, Representative Greenlick.
I mean, if you start getting into this, and I got cross-eyed trying to figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
The other piece you need is the work McKenzie did for the agency, putting in place the numbers that ought to be there. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I was impressed with the ability in one of the last budget changes to go from 40% of necessary personnel to 70% of necessary personnel. I mean, I just made those numbers up, but they're about that way in so many of your things. So part of it really is the problem that they have, work that we have assigned them by statute.
I'm not assessing blame or anything like that. It's just understanding, because we're going to go into November through February.
All I'm suggesting is we add to the understanding such issues as what's the appropriate personnel for these boxes as opposed to the existing personnel.
And that's
sort of mind-boggling to see how this agency works with a relatively low proportion of personnel to what this independent, internationally known management consultant says they need.
So I would simply say... That's a national figure too, right?
Simply get some of those figures in as well when we start looking at...
And I think it would be appropriate for this committee to learn that that we can advise the committee that Representative Greenlick is on.
Not anymore.
You're not on Ways and Means?
He bailed. I escaped.
Oh,
the Ways and Means.
Then it's especially important that we know this so that we can advise.
Oh, we don't have to be nice to him anymore. He heard that February was coming and said, that's it, I'm out of here. You know.
And Aaron, if you could also, I know Representative Harker, you have a question. But DD, that's developmental disability. Mm-hmm. SOCP, I don't know what that is. I've been doing
state-operated community programs.
Okay, so maybe you could give us sort of a cheat sheet to know what these all these mean? The AA would be Area Agency on Aging, right?
Mm-hmm.
But some of these letters, I think we all know what CFO is, but they're CEO Jim Scherzinger. That's, remind me what that is. I thought I knew.
Chief Operating Officer.
There, thank you. Right. So, yeah, some of those. So we know what those are. And I think that's an excellent question.
I've worked on enough corporate budgets to know that presented with a $2.3 billion budget, it's really easy to make a 10% cut.
Yeah.
But okay, what are these dollars? That's harder.
Yeah.
And especially if you've got holes that should be greater.
It's easy to make a 10% cut if that's the first time you did it.
Yeah.
Our problem is we're talking about a 10% cut now after we've already cut.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
And taking those low-hanging fruit on those corporate 10% that I've had.
I'm thinking where we're going in February is not going to be a 60,000-foot view. We're going to have to get pretty close to, about some on-the-ground operations or not, and there'll be consequences.
Yes.
I personally don't care if we cut out every program that Harker is interested in, but I have some I'm interested in. That
Representative Harker, now that we've heard your name,
Thank you. I have a question. Madam Chair, you've had a hard hiring freeze centrally for a number of years. I imagine you probably haven't had a hard freeze on IT expenditures. And I don't know these numbers at all, but on the Audits and IT Committee, I'm trying to get a good view into some of the silos of IT expenditures. And I'm wondering if you have any comments on the IT, the contribution, the real contribution to delivering services that has been delivered by IT expenditures within your purview in that time frame or thereabouts. And if you're not, it's probably not something you're directly involved with, and maybe you don't have a comment on it. But if you do, I'd love to hear it.
Co-chairs, Representative Harker, I came into this job saying, you know, I don't really know anything about IT. Someone else needs to do that, and I feel like that's all I really do right now. One of the reasons for that is that IT is one of the primary strategies that I have to not ask you for more staff and instead leverage technology to help me serve clients more efficiently. We just, 1 month ago Tuesday, launched a new child welfare IT structure that had been in development for a few years. It's called ORCIDS. We've presented to you in the past. That was a significant investment for us. In every case when we're having the conversation about the infrastructure of technology for the department, we're really talking about 20, 30, 40-year-old systems that are mainframe systems that people who where it is hard to find people to actually support and help us maintain or fix them when they break. And it's quite remarkable. I mean, if any of you have...
Paul, you ought to get him over to help you.
If you've ever had a chance, and you're welcome to do this anytime you'd like, to come sit next to one of our staff while they work in these systems, it is not easy. They work against you, not for you. We have a pretty... So our child welfare technology is new and on the ground, and we're working through, you know, anytime you take what was previously five separate and disparate, very old, antiquated systems and create one new web-based portal for data entry, there are going to be challenges, but remarkably, I'm not hearing from many of you that you're hearing from many of my staff yet, and I think we're cautiously optimistic that the system we know is working for kids and will work better for kids and also for provider payments, et cetera. We are working in close proximity to the Oregon Health Authority around the development of the exchange. That concept actually, though, came after the conversation which began with McKinsey around our staff and the need for automation of eligibility for our programs. Currently, our staff manually with a calculator for every person in the household determine eligibility for every individual, and the eligibility criteria for each program are different. And so it's an incredible amount of work for staff to actually complete the process of determining eligibility when we know that the computer really could import data. Once you have it in there and you enter it, it could automatically determine eligibility, and it could do so for multiple programs pretty quickly. That's the infrastructure that we're currently working to develop now. We call it modernization. In other words, moving into the, by the time we get there, hopefully we won't already be behind, but it's part of what now is happening inside the department, and it will dramatically change the way that we do our work. And so part of our conversation is about, you know, what does it look like on the ground for staff? And I think we will get to a point where instead of me coming to you, which I could today, and tell you that I have 68% of the staff I need to do the work around eligibility, that I can close that gap significantly just through the investment that you're making in me with technology, as opposed to more bodies and people on the ground. So that's something that we're studying. It will change our workflow, our work process. It will bring tons of efficiency to the department. And I think too often we ignore the role that technology can play in making government more efficient. So I've been really appreciative that the legislature has supported those investments even at a time when we're reducing programs. The other last thing I would say is this technology that we've been embarking on is one that can become the foundation for all of our programs, so we have better integrated data and we can provide that to you in a more comprehensive manner rather than having to go to separate programs for separate bodies of information.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Got a comment.
Erin, I hope that you will let us know what it is we need to know. I think it's part of our responsibility, or is our responsibility, being the policy committee, that we inform the Ways and Means Committee what policies we would just like to support. So we need to hear from you what information we need to have. So would you contact our staff or the one of us co-chairs and let us know, as I said, what it is we need to know about the Human Services Committee.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity and invitation.
Right. Thank you, and congratulations on your new position, I guess. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I congratulate you, too, and I wonder why you took the job sometimes. It's looking at the draft chart, talking about increased workloads and decreased resources make me appreciate something that I want to say that I've said to you, but I want to say with the whole committee here. I appreciate not only what you're doing in this new job, but for my experience, what you're doing in the area of the elder abuse issue, the way you worked during the session with your team, and now the way folks on your team continue to work with our task force. That alone is an overlay based on some other circumstances that maybe you weren't anticipating having to spend so much time on. I'm glad that you stepped up to do that. I appreciate so much your work, but also your staff continuing to engage with us and on the Elder Abuse Task Force, which we'll have a report for you all. And it is a tough job, and I am very impressed and appreciate very much your work.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Thank you so much for coming today, and thanks for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you all.
So I'm going to close the informational hearing. Representative Gilliam and I have worked together with our vice chairs to come up with a work plan for the interim, and November is going to be a very, very busy time, as we know. We've got several agencies we'll need to hear from, and Representative Gilliam is working really hard on the elder abuse, and so he's asking for an hour and a half of our committee time. So we have asked for and been given permission to have a four-hour meeting in November. Pardon?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may. If we let somebody other than Representative Gilliam testify on this, it might shorten it up to where we could do it in 2 hours.
I was just going to say, the bad news is we have an hour and a half. The good news is it's others presenting. You won't be listening to me for an hour and a half.
Well, we all look forward to it.
But I also add that we had a particularly heavy workload the other day in the healthcare meeting, and one of the co-chairs graciously brought refreshments to get everybody through that.
Really?
So if Gilliam would like, you know, step forward, it's
make that's it the responsibility of the chair.
Actually, I thought it was the responsibility of the vice chair, didn't you?
Definitely.
Yeah,
I make
maybe
a motion.
All four of
so it. Moved.
Yeah. All four could do it. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
So just heads up. And any other news for the good of the order? Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could elaborate on that.
Yes.
Members, I'll follow up with an email to asking you to block the time on your calendars. And what we don't know is if we're going to start early at 1, which may interfere with task forces that you all are on and meet at that hour, or if we have to stay late past 6 o'clock. I'll be asking you to block the whole time until
so
I hear.
6 o'clock Friday night?
Potentially, that's as late as it would go.
I think all of us would
it's
prefer 1 o'clock, 1 to 5 instead of 2 to
I'm ribbing this thing.
Setting aside the time in the event it's needed, hopefully we won't have to go for the entire 4 hours, but it's better to ask
Friday
in advance.
Next time or Monday, Tuesday,
it's on Friday. Also, that's the 18th of November, I believe.
That's above 16th. And beyond. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
I have 8 o'clock meetings that start that, and 8 o'clock meetings that start the day before. Going to 6 o'clock, I just think is. Not necessary. I don't have a problem with a four-hour meeting. Well,
Chairs and
have a problem with any meeting.
Representative Greenlake, if you'd like me to follow up, if you all relative are in agreement, I'll press the leadership offices with your preference to start at 1, even if one
agreeable?
Or two of you is gone, if you're on a task force.
So we could just move to Wednesday or Tuesday?
I think that that's set in stone.
Or Representative Greenlake, you could actually leave early.
We're following the same calendar we did today.
I think
yes.
That's my understanding.
That's correct.
Okay, anything else?
We kind of think of you two healthcare co-chairs as above and beyond.
Well, I mean, the fact is we spent, you know, the whole session with Friday afternoon committees.
It's awful.
In our session from 1 to 5. And you know, not only did we not try and stay over, we tried a little earlier. And, to me, stay till 6 o'clock on Friday, it's just ridiculous.
I think everybody's in agreement with you. So, and we're getting out early today. Maybe we will that day too, but I think block it out just in case we need it. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you very much. With that, I close the House Human Services Committee.